Connected live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Well, thanks so much for staying with us. Now, yesterday we spoke at length about what has happened over the weekend. You know, that Oval Office, very, very awkward conversation between Trump, Vance, his deputy, as well as Zelensky, who is the president of Ukraine. And there were many developments after that. He then went to the UK and you saw how lots of Europe, not all, but some, responded on Twitter very quickly and then very warmly welcome in the UK. But adjacent to that, we've had this ongoing, very strange case of South African whites represented, not all, Afrikaners represented by Solidarity, not all again, and AfriForum, who they say have gone to state their case in the US. In the meantime, pockets of organizations calling what South African Boer Afrikaners are facing in South Africa, they're calling genocide. Now, a South African court has dismissed a claim of white genocide in the country as clearly imagined and not real, and undermining comments made by US President Donald Trump and his advisor Elon Musk. So what I'm trying to say is that this is a court having declared this. In the meantime, these utterances continue, particularly by very high, officials in Donald Trump's advisory committees. One happened in the past 24 hours. On the line with us is Aisha Kaji, who is an international relations expert. Aisha, thank you so much for making time for us. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, Fanella. How are you doing?
I'm very perplexed, actually. So for the past week, Aisha, maybe a little longer, you've had Solidarity and AfriForum, you know, plead with South Africans to say, no, we have not gone to the US. And no, we did not tell the US that we are, you know, under attack, so to speak. But we feel, yes, but we feel that there are policies that need to be, you know, looked at and so on. And their tone seems to have changed, but it doesn't seem like that message is landing in the White House. Or what's going on here? Why the persistence of calling on the world to be alert to this genocide against Afrikaners when Solidarity on the one end is telling us, no, that's not what we're telling them. What's happening?
Well, I think on the, you know, first and foremost, given that we have been watching not one, but probably two genocides live streamed to us over the last several months, one in Gaza and the other one in the DRC in recent months. And maybe even others would claim even in Sudan, or at least at the very least ethnic cleansing there, right? Given that we're experiencing that and we're able to access that in real time very often, it's quite obvious there is no genocide happening in South Africa, as the court has ruled. But I think that we all know that Mr. Trump lives somewhat in his own delusionary world. I'm sorry to say this about a so-called world leader, but it's the truth, because he seems to make up his own version of the news and of facts. And, you know, he was the one who caused the term fake news to be coined in his first term. So, and I think he surrounds himself with people who are equally egalomaniacs, you know, egomaniacs and megalomaniacs, and who also equally have no basis in reality, Mr. Musk being one of those. And he's, of course, a former South African. Now, the fact that they're calling, you know, for refugee status for white South Africans who are facing a genocide, firstly, is ludicrous, as I've said. Secondly, I think it's meant to be provocative in international relations terms. They're looking for an excuse to target the South African government, and particularly President Ramaphosa, on two fronts. Firstly, they very strongly condemn and disapprove of South Africa's case against Gaza at the ICJ. Secondly, they disapprove of the Hague grouping. Thirdly, they don't like South Africa playing above its weight, punching above its weight in international terms, and the gravitas our country brings to such issues as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid. And fourthly, they are very, very much behind Rwanda's Mr. Kagame, who South African President Ramaphosa has taken a pretty firm stance with regard to what is currently going on in the DRC, which most analysts, including UN experts, have deemed to be at the hand of Rwanda's interference.
So you know, that's a lot there. And in a way, it makes me feel like it doesn't matter what envoy the president sends to the U.S. They've decided this is their stance, and they've decided this is how they feel about South Africa. And therefore, what should then South Africa be doing in response to all of this?
Well, I think that Mr. Ramaphosa's response has been fairly measured, and it's a good type of measured. I think also that, you know, they essentially, Mr. Musk and Mr. Trump are bully boys. They have demonstrated that very ably in their handling of Mr. Zelensky earlier this week. What we saw on live television was mafia-style bullying and intimidation and thuggery tactics, quite frankly. You know, even to the extent of criticizing Mr. Zelensky's dress. So I think that is the kind of tone that is setting foreign policy for the U.S. And they will try this with South Africa, as they will try it with others, that whose either foreign policy or domestic policy or both they don't approve of. What South Africa should do in response is to court other players on the international stage, which we are already doing, including other Western players as well as non-Western ones, such as in East Africa, in Asia, in the Southern America, Canada, etc. So we are doing that, and we are doing that pretty successfully. As I said, as a country, we have a certain degree of gravitas. However, I think to maintain that gravitas, we must also show our commitments to human rights very equally across the board, both internally and externally. We recently passed the long overdue land expropriation bill, which led to this fracca in the first place. We must now ensure that the way that bill is applied is fair and just and does not give anybody cause to actually start claiming there's a genocide in this country. I mean, if you look at statistics, in 1 year, I think it was between 2023 and 2024, there were 12 murders that happened on farms. Only one was of a farm owner. Yeah. The others were farm dwellers. So, you know, and while that those are not broken down racially, it's likely that the farm owner was white. We know that 72% of the agricultural land in this country is owned by white people, who make up just over 7% of the population. On the other hand, the farm dwellers, and specifically of the others, about five were farm workers. Those are most likely to be black people.
You've just described President Trump and Elon Musk as aggressors, essentially, and bullies, as you said. That, if we take that into account, I'm not sure that whatever response our president gives is going to allow them to just sit still. They may continue to provoke. Then what?
I think they will continue to provoke, because that is in their nature. They attempt to, as it were, rule. You know, they see themselves as imperial powers rather than democracy. We've seen that in their internal handling of affairs as well. And so they see themselves as imperial, as neo-colonists, and as having the right to do what they want to do even outside their own boundaries. And of course, their multinational corporations, particularly the military-industrial complex, but also other technocrats, have assisted and ableized this by the extraction of minerals in places such as Congo and the Sudan.
So we are going to be, presiding over the G20. They've already told us they're not coming, but they're supposed to hand it over. We are supposed to hand it over to them. They don't like our themes. They don't like our agenda. To what extent can they stay out of the G8, and will it backfire on them? Because that's maybe going to be a vacuum that somebody else will occupy.
Absolutely. I think it's already backfiring on them in terms of their policy towards Ukraine. We've seen, immediate, almost immediate calls from players in Europe to actually unite and unite on a defense stance. In other words, that looks like there's a possible fracturing of NATO, which will be immensely detrimental to the U.S. in terms of its global leverage, if you will. Hmm. And it's got military bases in various parts of the former Russian Union, the former Soviet Republic, but it's also not got the capacity to maintain those at a distance without Western Europe's cooperation and collaboration. And I think this is going to backfire very, very badly on them if they continue in this vein. And certainly, if the hawks that are currently advising Mr. Trump and the technocrats and oligarchs who are currently advising Mr. Trump continue with this kind of policy, I think what you might see, and I think that's possibly what they want, is an uprising within the U.S., people coming out on the streets and demonstrating, etc., because I think Mr. Trump is actually looking for the excuse to use military power against his own people.
Gosh, that's chilling, Aisha. I didn't think of it that way. But I just want to maybe pick your brain on the Democrats' response to this. Quite mute, in my view. I mean, am I maybe missing something?
I think the Democrats in the last 2 years moved so far towards the center that they actually moved over into the right.
Ouch.
And particularly with Kamala Harris's campaign courting the so-called liberal Republican vote. Mm. I think that was a huge error in judgment on her part. I think she could have gone in a very different direction and still, had a decent chance at the presidency. But I also really blame Mr. Biden. His policies both with Ukraine and Israel, as well as his insistence on remaining in power well beyond his sell by, frankly.
So let's then focus a little bit on what's happening in Gaza, because unfortunately the world's lens now has moved a little bit, and a lot has been happening over the past couple of days where now aid has stopped coming in. We're back to tensions again with the peace deal. And so, because the lens has moved, the media's lens has moved, I'm worried that we may be regressing again there.
I think we are regressing then. There's no maybe about it. This was a genocide that was only on pause for a very short time. Most analysts of the Middle East warned that Mr. Netanyahu would do this, but nobody listened amongst the sort of policy makers and deal makers, etc. Nobody listened, and now it's come to fruition. Gaza is still starving. Northern Gaza is still starving. About 8 or 10 babies to date have perished due to cold.
Cold, yeah.
And yet the extraordinary of the resilience of the Gazan people is still something that Israel hasn't come to terms with, because they are determined to rebuild. And I say resilience very hesitantly, Penelo, because I don't want that resilience to become normalized. I don't want their suffering to become normalized, the genocide against them to become normalized. But also we must remember, it's not just Gaza. For the last 50 days, Israel has been carrying out a campaign in the West Bank.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Literally, while the Oscars were going on and no other land was winning the best Oscar for the Oscar for Best Documentary, literally while that was going on, bulldozers were raising homes and settlers were moving into homes in Masafer Yatta, which is the area that this documentary actually focuses on. It's really, truly ironic. It seems like something out of a horror movie.
Well, Netanyahu, I don't know if he's going to move, because domestically there is pressure for him to continue with this hostility. And obviously the U.S. has already declared the fact that they must carry on with this hostility. Where does that leave, that arrangement of us getting closer to peace? I'm afraid to ask, Aisha, what's next?
Well, I don't think either Netanyahu or his government, his cabinet members, ever truly wanted peace. Mm. There have been widespread and long-held allegations, behind the scenes that Ben Gvir and Smotrich made a deal with him. Mm. And that deal was that they would be allowed to annex wide swaths of the West Bank, of the Golan Heights in Syria, and of Beirut. And we saw Mr. Netanyahu in the Knesset 2 days ago saying that the war would continue on 7 fronts. Mm. That is a very, very war-mongering statement. And we've also seen statements from people like the Deputy Speaker of the Knesset saying, essentially calling for ethnic cleansing and total genocide. Kill everybody, kill them during Ramadan when they are weakened, etc., etc. You know.
Yeah.
So I think that really, you know, in as much as Mr. Trump lives in a fantasy world where he can, you know, become that tycoon, property tycoon who develops a Riviera of the Middle East in Gaza, you know, with a total eradication of Palestinian culture and memory and eradication of Palestinian identity, so too Mr. Netanyahu inhabits a similar fantasy world.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we live in an era where the one, the colonizer, the occupier, i.e. Israel, has the technology at its disposal to actually carry out that threat of ethnic cleansing. And we have the enabler, the U.S., having sent 2,000-pound bombs once again, as Mr. Biden did, but Mr. Trump, in his first 100 days in office, has done it twice already. Sending, you know, these bombs that really wreak utter devastation, combined with the Israeli technology, or the technology they have either refined over decades or bought from others, that becomes a hugely, hugely problematic and evil machinery, mechanism at their disposal. We are truly talking about a David and Goliath situation here.
Yeah.
We're not talking about an equal playing field.
Yeah.
We're talking about children throwing stones versus a nuclear superpower. We need to bear that in mind. This is occupied territory. It is not two states fighting each other. It is not two peoples on an equal playing field.
When we go back to what happened over the weekend between Trump, Vance and Zelensky, I get a sense that really we kicked off sort of a new order, world order here with that. But I mean, as in very rapidly, as you said, live on television, because suddenly with what Europe, some of Europe's response was showing us is that, and obviously Starmer's response as well, declaring that, you know, let's try and get this alliance of the willing going, and they will also support if needs be with boots on the ground. I got a sense that there's a new, maybe bromance is too strong a word, between the UK and Brexit, after Brexit, with Europe. And things are starting to move differently. What do you make of the relationship between the UK now and Europe and how it's evolving?
I think the UK is possibly moving closer to Europe on foreign policy issues. Not necessarily on issues that affect it domestically. Mr. Starmer is still pretty conservative, despite the naming of his party, etc. He's still a pretty, you know, right-wing guy. And I think his stance on immigration, for example, will not change. And that's a big one for the rest of Western Europe. His stance on things like a common currency will not change. But I think we might see more cooperation within NATO, or within a NATO minus the US, even. Because Western Europe has far more reason to want to maintain a status quo between itself and Russia than the United States does at this point, given its proximity to Russia, and given Mr. Putin and his allies' delight at what happened earlier this week.
So, I mean, what are the chances? Because here we have already Trump having halted immediately aid to Ukraine. That was very swift. And the debate now that's coming about supporting Ukraine and whether anybody will actually plug that hole, what then becomes of Ukraine? They are struggling, as Zelensky's been saying.
They are struggling, yes, that's true. But remember that Zelensky was brought to power by a coalition that did not want to see Russia dominate parts of Ukraine.
Mm.
And while that sentiment still remains within Western Europe and even within Britain to some extent, I think that if push comes to shove, Zelensky will be told to make a deal with Putin and possibly hand over parts of the Donbas and the Crimea.
Yeah.
Because he really, you know, he's not in a position militarily.
He's in the corner, yeah.
To do without the Western Europe and you, particularly U.S. support.
You know, it's obviously not palatable, and especially in the tone with which Trump, you know, pushes the line of sign the deal or else type thing. But perhaps it does need to be considered, to your point. But what would be the considerations for Ukraine? Yes, I know that he wants security, but that, what I would call a business deal, is it viable? The minerals deal.
Well, you know, I think it's either that or he caves to the U.S. demand of hand us your mineral rights, basically, and we'll protect you. And I think that if I were in his shoes, and I am certainly not an aspirant statesman, no Georgia Maloney, I think that, you know, if that were the choice Zelensky faced, he would go with the former, rather lose a part of the already occupied Ukrainian lands that Russia sees as belonging to it, not without any justification. I'm not excusing Russia's invasion by any means, but I'm saying that there was NATO aggression, you know, in the build up to this. It was passive aggression, but it was aggression nonetheless.
What or who will actually get Putin to stick to the agreement, whatever the agreement is, and honor it?
Again, I think that would depend on what the peace brokers, as they see themselves, including, by the way, you know, right-wingers such as Maloney, who I just mentioned, what they see as in their best interests, both with regard to Ukrainian gas, which powers much of Western Europe, and also with regard to what they think would be an effective deterrent for Mr. Putin. So they may offer more trade ties, for example, you know, longer term trade agreements with Mr. Putin, even with some of his allies in the region, etc. And frankly, that might actually be in the whole of Europe's best interest.
Of course. Because if you know, if you can do that, you secure Europe in a way. Because if you don't,
so you know, a combination of hard and soft power is what I'm talking about, really. You know, offer trade deals, offer Ukraine long-term security, or like, you know, a security guarantee in return for long-term access to gas, not access as in free gas, but at a price, of course. So that helps to uplift the Ukrainian economy once again, etc. But also cede some territory to Mr. Putin and hope that would satisfy him in the medium to long term.
Yeah, because the gas wasn't enough. The gas wasn't enough.
Yes, it's always a fragile hope. But in terms of, for example, you know, trade deals with Russia. Russia has huge reserves of wheat, for example, fertilizer crops, etc. That can be brought into, you know, fairly tight and mutually beneficial trade deal.
Does that then leave Trump out of the deal? Maybe.
If he continues to behave in this fashion.
Aisha, thank you so much for your time. Really wonderful talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Benella. Take care. Bye-bye.
Aisha Kaji, international relations expert.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.